This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beach. My name is Marla Damati. Today on the show, a powerful documentary has been released highlighting the exploitation of Pacifica rugby players, and it's titled Oceans Apart, Greed, Betrayal and Pacific Rugby. What a title there. Later on in the program, you'll hear more about the must-see documentary made by former Samoa forward Dan Leo. And is there a sense of deja vu in PNG politics? In just a little under 10 minutes' time, I'll be joined by PNG constitutional law expert Bel Kama to discuss the unfolding situation in PNG and whether it might play out similarly to the 2011 constitutional crisis. But next, the PNG budget was rushed through so fast they forgot to fund the country's most vital medical service.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Extraordinary events in Papua New Guinea's parliament this week saw the government's 2021 national budget passed, but did so with most of the opposition absent. The rushed process has sparked concern about the level of scrutiny placed on spending decisions, and one vital organisation was left reeling after its funding appeared to be stripped altogether. St John Ambulance, PNG's only emergency medical service, was expecting to receive 10 million kina next year. The ABC has been told that the cuts are a mistake and that the Treasury intends to fix it, but the issue has called into question broader issues about the 2021 budget, as Marion Farr reports.
A budget passed in a hurry has left one organisation in shock.
Look, at this point in time, we haven't been able to find ourselves in the budget, and that's caught us by surprise.
St John Ambulance, which relies on government funding to provide emergency medical care to PNG citizens, was expecting to receive 10 million kina, or about 4 million Australian dollars. But government's national budget, passed in a rushed parliamentary sitting on Tuesday morning, had no mention of funding for the service. A surprise to CEO Matt Cannon.
The first biggest concern for us and my team is our patients. If the government can't provide funding needed in 2021, we have 180 employees that serve a population of around 9 million people. We're the only public emergency ambulance service for Papua New Guinea.
He says the organisation was banking on government support, with plans to expand services to Lae, Medang and Simbu province next year.
We need that funding more than ever. There's been an exponential growth in the number of people requiring St John's emergency service each year. It's about a 35% increase in patients per annum that we're seeing at the moment.
On top of emergency care, St John has also been operating a drive-through COVID-19 testing centre in Port Moresby, the nation's capital. Matt Cannon says the funding cuts were a mistake due to the budget's passing being rushed.
But we've reached out to Treasury and to the Health Department, and we understand that there was some oversight and that that's being fixed at the moment.
But the issue has raised concern about the level of scrutiny placed on public spending decisions for the coming year. Paul Barker is an economist and the executive director of the Institute of National Affairs in PNG. He says this week's budget session was extraordinary.
Instead of the normal routine of having a budget lock-up in which the press and others participate and get good detail, it was tabled in a hurry in the morning, basically to avoid being held up by a possible court injunction. So they went ahead, tabled it, and passed it there and then in the morning. So there wasn't the normal opportunity for the parliamentarians to examine in any detail. But anyway, they went ahead. And of course, they also went ahead at the time when the opposition were mostly out of town and weren't even able to participate anyway. So it was a rather unusual situation, and clearly that's frustrated the opposition.
He says while a budget provides a blueprint for spending, it's not necessarily set in stone.
Well, there are always some mistakes that occur in the budget, but obviously it has that direct impact. But to some extent, PNG has got a level of administrative flexibility. So, yeah, I don't think they should despair. There will be some sort of capacity within there, so long as it gets prioritised by the government, to both find savings somewhere else as the year progresses. But, you know, certainly to look out for something early on. I mean, I'm not saying that that will happen, but that there is that level of greater flexibility.
A spokesman for the Department of Treasury has told the ABC health is being prioritised in the 2021 budget, and the mistake around funding for St John Ambulance would be fixed. But the exact amount the emergency service provider will receive is still unclear. Paul Barker says finding extra money could be hard.
Next year, certainly, the budget is looking very tight. Yeah, although they're saying it's prioritising health, education and law and order, policing, etc., nevertheless, the government agencies and non-government agencies, apart from paying salaries, the actual operational costs are very tight. So the capacity to actually perform and deliver very limited, whereas, as I say, there's quite a substantial increase in the capital budget.
That outlook has prompted concern among PNG health professionals, including Dr. Edith Carrico, Vice President of the PNG Women's Doctors Association.
So, I mean, you need stability for decision-making, or crucial decision-making to happen. And, you know, when you look at your authorities within the health system, a lot of them are politically driven, so that political stability is very essential in that regard.
But she says the sector is learning to live with political turmoil.
I think what's happening in the country is not new for those of us who work here in this context. The main thing is you get your system strengthened. So there is a fine line between politics and the system. So once those systems are strengthened, your processes are in place, you should be able to continue business as usual in the midst of this.
Matt Cannon is trying to remain optimistic. But if funding isn't secured soon, the cash-strapped service could be in serious trouble. With the year almost over, it's received only a third of 3 million kina it was promised by the PNG government for 2020.
And it's meant that we've had to cut back on operational activities throughout this year. And that's come at a time where demand's higher than it's ever been. The last situation we want to be in and what we're currently faced with is a serious conversation around suspending services over the Christmas New Year period, because we still haven't been paid the full amount that we need for 2020. And the Christmas New Year period puts extra strain on us. So last year we attended to 1,642 emergency incidents over Christmas, and we're expecting that to increase to around 2,000 this year.
He says having to wind back its footprint in PNG would have a big impact.
It would just have dire consequences for the communities that we serve across Papua New Guinea if St John was not able to provide those services. And already there's discussion that, you know, if the budget issue isn't fixed, or the remaining funding from government for this year isn't paid, you know, there's serious conversations being had at the moment around, do we have to start selling ambulances as second-hand vehicles to raise money to keep the service running? And, of course, that's an absolute last consideration. But at this point in time, with the lack of support that's coming, we're having to explore all options, and all options are on the table right now.
That was Matt Cannon from St John Ambulance Service, ending that report by Marion Farr.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The issues that have played out on the floor of Parliament over the past few days will now see a new battleground, the courts. Last night, former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill filed an application questioning the interpretation and application of constitutional laws when Parliament was reconvened on Tuesday, when the budget was passed without the opposition present, and when the Parliament was adjourned to May 2021. Dr. Bal Karma is a PNG constitutional law expert and joins me now to unravel how this might play out in front of the courts. Good morning, Dr. Bal.
Good morning.
You are a constitutional law expert. What is your take on the situation that's going on?
The situation is at play. I think it's a very complex situation. The courts are not new to this. They have dealt with similar issues in the past, so the judges are quite familiar with the importance of the issue and the sensitivity of the issue, and how to go about, you know, bringing a decision that is consistent with the law. So I think it'll be interesting how courts decide on this issue.
One thing, how do you see this playing out in the courts, and do you think this is a matter of high urgency as well?
The court's initial take on the issue is that it is not a matter of high urgency. When they ruled last week, on Monday, but I think what we will see is that the opposition will put pressure on the court to to attend to this, and I think the court will now move to this mindset where this is urgent, this is for the stability of the country, this is a national interest issue, and so we have to come to a decision on this sooner.
Now, we've seen countless times, like you mentioned before, the courts being called in to settle legal arguments for politicians, including the constitutional crisis of 2011 when the Supreme Court ruled on who was meant to be the country's prime minister. In your mind, as someone who is, working in this space, why do you think this keeps happening?
I think the political landscape in Papua New Guinea is quite fluid. And one of the most important, I think, factors for that is this notion of this scheme of vote of no confidence, which kicks in every 18 months when a new government is voted in, and so that creates a very very dynamic space where political power is always there's a potential to shift political power from parties and from groups. Once that plays out in parliament, sometimes in a way that is not legal, the issue ended up in the courts. So the last 20 years, we've been seeing that happening with the Somare government and then with the O'Neill government, and now we are seeing it played out with this government under the James, or under the Prime Minister of James Marape. The thing about the courts in Papua New Guinea and the constitution is that it has such a broad powers, and it is a very a very liberal kind of constitution where courts are given the mandate to look into those kind of issues, and judges in fact have declare that they are there not to turn a blind eye to politics, and they should take interest in political and policy issues, because at the end they all custodians of the people of Papua New Guinea. So I think with that mind frame, courts are quite open to dealing with issues that to the countries like Australia, some of the issues might appear to be a very political issue, not for the courts. In Papua New Guinea, that is quite different. Judges are open to, once the issue is brought to them, they're open to look into that.
Talking about the constitution and how it is quite liberal in its interpretation in different kinds of scenarios, in your mind, between the application that was put forward and Prime Minister Marape's decisions, who do you think is in the right in terms of the legal processes that are going forward now?
I think... And my opinion, with the law as it is now, understanding orders of Parliament, the first calling or the first incident last week where the opposition leader decided to adjourn Parliament, having the majority of Parliament to do that, that is inconsistent with the standing orders. Standing Order 43 says that only a minister can adjourn Parliament. So that is the basis to which the government brought the challenge, and then the Speaker decided to call Parliament because they said what the opposition did was not consistent with the standing order. However, the Speaker calling the Parliament again, with the organic law, Section 2 says that it is only in the case of emergency, a national emergency, where the Speaker can call Parliament. And if not, if there is no emergency, then the Governor General, acting on the advice of the National Executive Council, can call Parliament. So again, the opposition is saying that, yes, we may have got it wrong in the first place, but you also got it wrong by calling Parliament in our absence. And I think both of this now become the court's issue to look at. Yes, does the standing order appears to be breached and the organic law appears to be breached, but how can we resolve this? What is the correct interpretation?
And what is the most beneficial outcome, not necessarily for either political party, but for the people of Papua New Guinea? What outcome would see there be a little bit more stability and a little bit less of these questions in the air?
That is a very important question, Mara. When we look at previous vote of no confidence, previous such pooling intention in Papua New Guinea, people have been the most important kind of factor. The way people move, the way popular dissent are happening or happened, that has always become a deciding factor for change of government. And we saw that with the last government, Peter O'Neill government, for instance, there were numerous protests. In fact, bloody protests. Police have shot a few of the students that have gone about protesting against the government then. And we have seen such protests and such public dissent, popular public dissent, widespread over many years, where there has been challenges to government and vote of no confidences. But in this instance, it's quite fascinating that there is no that sense of public dissent, widespread popular public dissent against the Marape government. In fact, the opposite appears to be from what we have judged or looked at it so far. People appears to be quite supportive of Marape, and that's due to some of the reforms that he has brought into Papua New Guinea. For instance, he's brought the Anti-Corruption Act, a issue for Papua New Guinea for so long. And he is clamped down on the mining and resource sector. He's trying to make sure that the people of Papua New Guinea have a fair share of their resources. And I think those sense of reforms have created a sense of public support for this government. So I think that is the threshold for me. That is the threshold where, if we are seeing public dissent, then I think the likelihood of change of government is actually high. But if we're not seeing it, then that very, very important factor that have always underpinned change of government is actually missing in this event.
What do you think PNG's partners like Australia will take on the situation that's unfolding? Of course, they are watching very closely, and Australia did have something to say back in 2011. But what do you think PNG's partners will take on the situation that's unfolding at the moment?
Definitely, Canberra is watching very, like you said, very, very intently. Prime Minister Scott Morrison was supposed to go to Papua New Guinea yesterday, but he didn't due to the situation. I think Australia would be definitely interested, given that there are many other issues that is going on in around this whole region, and Papua New Guinea is one of the most important partners in the region. At this stage, I think there will be no. I think that Australia have learned its lessons in 2011 and back, where similar situations happen, in terms of providing any direct comments or influence. But that said, I think if the situation gets out of hand, if the democracy and the constitution and the rule of law is at stake, then Australia, as a leading democracy, it'd be wise perhaps to make some, comments in terms of trying to guide the leaders to do the right thing. But we are not at this stage of instability yet. I think what we are seeing in Papua New Guinea is a normal political tension, and what's been played out is something that's based on the constitution in terms of the vote of no at the vote of no confidence. So there is nothing to kind of worry, I would say, at this stage. But Papua New Guinea can be a land of the unexpected. So we are all watching closely.
Absolutely. Dr. Bell, thank you so much for joining me this morning on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Marla.
That was PNG constitutional law expert Dr. Bell Karma speaking to me there about the constitutional law in PNG.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Still to come on the program, you're going to get a weather update from Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather, and Talia Olatia will bring you the latest news and developments from the region. But first, a bit of music. This is Bobby Alu with Other Side.
And you click three times, you're in. Where you been? All this time looking for a remedy to change your life. Keep on knocking, waiting for the right time. When am I ready to strike? Light it up. All I'm looking for is a way to the other side. A way to the other side. Way to the other side.
That was Other Side by Bobby Alu. It's time now to get a look at the weather across the region, and to do that I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Marla.
It looks like the weather has settled a little bit over the region.
Yeah, look, we do have this big high pressure still, which is sitting in the Tasman Sea, and that's creating generally settled weather across most parts. About the only places that are seeing any significant precipitation today will be the Cooks, where we just have this frontal system, which has just been slow moving. It hasn't moved away very far at all, and there may be a shower or two further back over the Samoas as well, American and Independent Samoa. Elsewhere, it's really just the afternoon and evening convective showers that everybody's pretty familiar with this time of the year. Most parts of the region remain fairly fine and settled with lots of sunshine in the morning, which means hot and steaming.
And north of the equator, are we keeping our eye on anything? Is anything going on over there?
No, it's all pretty quiet up there. Still a few showers lingering about the Marshall Islands, but nothing of any consequence. And most of Micronesia is fine and clear this morning. Very dry still along the equator. That's La Nina-driven weather. It has been dry along there for best part of a couple of months now. So sadly for them, no rain on the horizon. But yeah, looking pretty quiet for the moment, and we should see it stay that way pretty much through the end of the week and over the weekend.
Well, no news is good news in some cases when it comes to weather in the north of the equator. But Neville, thank you so much for bringing us that weather update.
You're welcome.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, you can head on over to Facebook and search Nandraki Weather. Talia Olatia joins us this morning to bring us the news and developments from across the region. Good morning, Talia.
Tala falava.
Now, let's quickly turn to Samoa because there is breaking news at hand. What's going on there?
So Samoa was one of the countries that hasn't had a COVID-19 case, but no longer, unfortunately, with the government of Samoa this morning confirming reports that the country has recorded its first positive case of coronavirus. It involves a man who tested positive. He's a sailor who arrived in Samoa on a repatriation flight from Auckland last Friday. The Prime Minister, Tuilepe Selele Maliilengaoi, has called for calm amid the news. And there will, of course, be more to come, but that is just what is coming out now, that Samoa has recorded its first case of COVID-19.
And we'll keep you up to date across ABC Radio Australia and Pacific Beat on any updates in the situation in Samoa. Now let's turn to the Solomon Islands because polling is currently underway for the two by-elections.
That's right. There are two seats up for grabs, one in the capital Honiara and the other in the northeast Guadalcanal. Both by-elections were triggered after the former members were found guilty of bribing voters during last year's election. Now what's particularly interesting is that the running candidates in these two by-elections include the wives of those ousted MPs. Both Ethel Lency for northeast Guadalcanal is Jamie Vokia's wife, rather, and Jenny Fagui for central Honiara is Moffat Fagui's wife, and they're both contesting this by-election in the hopes of reclaiming their husband's seats. Now, you might remember back in July, I spoke to Karen Baker from the Australian National University because being the wife of a former member of parliament in the Pacific appears to be an effective way for women to get into politics in the Pacific, and you can obviously see this happening in these by-elections. Also in the mix for these two seats up for grabs are former prime ministers, Derek Sakua, who is contesting the northeast Guadalcanal seat, and Gordon Darcy Lilly is also contesting the central Honiara seat. So there looks like there's going to be lots of competition on hand. People were actually, in order to vote in these two constituencies, were given a public holiday to do so. That's something I'd like to see here in Australia. Like every time we vote, we get a public holiday. And the Electoral Commission has said that counting for both by-elections would start on Friday and the results are expected over the weekend.
Now, let's turn to Fiji. In the hopes of improving the treatment of female soldiers in Fiji's military, they're rolling out a new gender policy.
Yeah, that's right. It's being done in the hopes of meeting United Nations targets and, as you said, hopes to improve the treatment of female soldiers, as well as encouraging more women to join the army. The UN threshold for female personnel is currently at 15%, but will increase to 25% in 2025. Now, according to figures from Radio New Zealand, there were 464 women compared to 7,457 men in the Fijian army last year, which is actually only a percentage of 6% and not the 15%. But talking to RNZ Pacific, the highest ranking female in the Fijian army, Colonel Latia Seru Iratu, says women face huge challenges wearing the uniform and said that the gender integration policy would need to include sustainable pathways and integrated supporting networks for women into the force, which would include equipping women when they go out on peacekeeping missions for the UN. Colonel Seru Iratu is also Fiji's first female peacekeeping commander. She said it took her 10 years to join the peacekeeping missions, and she says that women face strong emotional and psychological challenges abroad and therefore need to be supported. Here's a little bit of her talking to Radio New Zealand Pacific.
The exposure to the threats, the conflicts, and we have seen this with women, and the ability to process what they've gone through. And I'm glad that I'm hearing that we will be afforded this opportunity. The meaningful participation of women and girls in the whole spectrum of peace operations is very important because we bring a difference into the whole spectrum, working alongside our military partners to ensure a safe and secure environment that we will live in peacefully.
That was Colonel Seru Iratu there. Finally, and to quote you this morning, I guess we should talk... To quote you this morning, when we were sitting down at our desk, I guess we should talk about the Queensland winning the State of Origin. You said with a sigh, slightly downrodden.
Yeah.
What's happened? What happened last night? I see Brendan, our tech, pumping his arms, but Talia looks a bit sad. Yeah. Why are you sad, Talia?
Queensland won. See you in 2021. The end. Bye. No, that's not right. Last night, Queensland did beat New South Wales 20-14 in the State of Origin decider, meaning that for the first time in 3 years, they got to lift the State of Origin shield in front of their 50,000-strong home crowd. You know, New South Wales has had it for 3 years. We thought we would share it. We're nice. Like that. First half tries from Valentine Holmes and Edric Lee set up the Queensland Maroons with a lead going into half time. And look, New South Wales' chances look slim after captain James Tedesco was forced off the field in the first half after suffering a head knock, which really left a hole in the Blues' attack. Queensland, let's be honest, they dominated the second half, but the New South Wales defence held strong to ensure that the final score wasn't a complete blowout. And despite desperate attempts from New South Wales to overcome the team dub dubbed the worst Queensland team ever. Had to get that in there. The Maroons did hold on to claim victory. Queensland's Cameron Munster was named man of the match, and Queensland legend Jonathan Thurston said after the game it was one of Queensland's greatest Origin wins ever. I guess they can have it.
I just the every time you had to say the word Queensland there, I could just see your body kind of recoil a little bit.
Bethany Harriman will be the worst today. I already expect it.
Well, thank you for bringing us the news across the region and for talking about the state of Origin. But thank you for joining us this morning, Talia.
Thanks, Marla.
And just repeating the news, just in Samoa has recorded their first case of COVID-19 as reported by the government.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Still to come on the program, the Flying Fijians have been hit hard by COVID-19 on what should have been a high-profile tour, a rugby tour of Europe. You'll find out what the reaction has been back in Fiji. And the World Health Organization has launched a plan to end cervical cancer. But first, some more music. This is Vika and Linda Bull with Down on the Jetty.
Me crying down on the jetty. You left me standing all on my own. Your boat got smaller, then smaller and smaller. I kept my eyes on you.
That was Down on the Jetty by Vika and Linda Bull.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right, you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Marla Damati. Their home country may be free of the virus, but the Flying Fijians have been hit hard by COVID-19 on what should have been a high-profile rugby tour of Europe. At the last count, 29 players and staff in Fiji's training bubble in France have tested positive for coronavirus, and the next scheduled match against Italy in the Autumn Nations Cup has already been called off. Back in the islands, rugby fans are urging the Fiji Rugby Union to abandon the tour for the sake of the players' health. But as Richard Hewitt reports, there are also big financial contracts at stake.
It should have been the perfect launch pad for the Flying Fijians' new coach, Vern Cotter. Three matches against three Tier 1 nations, France, Italy and Scotland. But a trio of positive COVID-19 tests in Fiji's training bubble was enough to lead to the French game being forfeited. So with the number of active cases now one short of 30, it was inevitable that this weekend's scheduled match against Italy would also be scrapped. Former Fiji Rugby Union board member and the editor of Te Vovo Rugby magazine, Kulden Kamea, says it's another bitter blow.
Just very, very sad, very unfortunate. We can understand the guys are very excited to go there and to participate. First time ever being invited into this Six Nations competition. It's an opportunity to play with the Tier 1 nations, and it's very unfortunate that it's blown up on them in this way.
Speaking to the media in Suva, the chairman of the Fiji Rugby Union, Conway Begg, was doing his best to remain upbeat.
It's tough to be on the team. Two matches on the trot. We're looking forward to taking something positive out of this, you know, working around the fringes, hoping that something comes out of this. But, you know, it was an opportunity to take part. We knew the circumstances. We had to mitigate, and we've done the best we can.
But even while the chairman was talking during a Facebook Live broadcast, comment after comment was calling for the tour to be abandoned. Break camp. The welfare of the players is paramount. There'll be plenty of game time in years to come. You should have thought about their welfare before sending them off. France is in lockdown, and yet you still sent them. Japan foresaw this problem, hence they pulled out from the tournament because their priorities were right. You have a sick team, and your priority is to pull the plug, swallow your pride, and get the boys out of there as soon as possible. Kulden Kamea says the issues are not straightforward, but he can sympathise with the fans' points of view.
Yeah, that's understandable, but I think the organisers of the tournament have got a commitment. I understand it's a £20 million deal with Amazon to broadcast this tournament. So there's all those commercial obligations to work through. If they can play against Scotland in their last pool game, that'll be worth something. But I think at the moment, with 29 players down, it's high risk.
And Kulden Kamea is also concerned about what the local contingent of players will face on their return to Fiji.
I'm sure Fiji Rugby Union and the organisers will take the best medical advice from the French and from World Rugby. And I'm sure player welfare will be right at the top of their list of priorities. And we just wish the guys come back to Fiji safely. We're COVID-free in Fiji. And now these guys are exposed to it there. So they'll have to go through the protocols to come back into the country. And we've managed it very well so far, but if the 7 or 8 blokes who went up from here come back and they've had it well, it just could be an issue for our country as well.
The FIU's chief executive, John O'Connor, was due to be involved in talks with World Rugby overnight, and he says there are standby players available to replace some of those who are sick, but they won't be called into camp just yet.
We've had the standby players ready to come in, but because of the uncertainty, because when somebody is in the bubble and one gets it, and the likelihood it will spread, because we've been training and all this contacting. So that's why I'm reluctant.
Another round of coronavirus tests will be conducted in the Fiji camp on Friday, but at this stage, the prospect of the team seeing any action in the Autumn Nations Cup is looking bleak. However, Kulden Kamea says accepting the invitation to compete in the midst of a pandemic was still a chance worth taking.
We knew there was high risk going into France for this tournament, absolutely new given the situation with COVID, and it's just unfortunate that it's hit the team like this in a very big way. Totally devastating.
Kulden Kamea ending that report from Richard Hewitt.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
A decade ago, when Dan Leo called out the Samoa Rugby Union over corruption allegations, he was dropped from the national team and never played for the Manu again. Since then, as a founder and chief executive of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, Leo has gone on to be a powerful voice for Pacific players all over the world. And now he has just released a film documentary called Oceans Apart, which crystallizes much of what he believes is wrong with rugby in the Pacific, particularly in Tonga and Samoa, and who is to blame. Richard Hewitt took a look at the movie and he's been speaking to Dan Leo about it.
In 2016, I set out to find the real stories behind why Pacific Rugby is struggling. And despite providing many of the world's top players to an ever-profitable sport, the island nations of Samoa, Tonga and Fiji increasingly find themselves on the edge of bankruptcy.
The overriding points of the documentary was to make sure that Tonga and Samoa aren't being forgotten about, that we are increasing the betterment of the governance in our nations so that we can put ourselves back in that shop window. We wouldn't want to see two awesome nations just left by the wayside.
80-20 split. It's not going to hurt England.
Where the rugby values in taking £4 million from a rugby match as your gate receipts and your broadcast, not even sharing them with an impoverished nation.
They should be remunerated, you know, and I think that should be part of ticket sales from the day. Everyone puts their hand up, says they're going to do good stuff, and then nothing happens because no one does anything about it and everyone just forgets about it. We do a huddle of solidarity, we go with your brother, and then we go off and play, you know, New Zealand next week. That's the way it goes.
There was perhaps a bit of a breakthrough that the Tier 1 nations were prepared to talk, but now those talks are on hold, and I'm guessing COVID-19 may or may not have something to do with that. So how optimistic are you that eventually the Samoas, the Fijis, the Tongas of this world will get, you know, at least a 10% share when they play in front of a packed house in Twickenham?
The reality is that those conversations had gone cold before COVID struck, and that's the worry. And I guess one of the aims of the documentary is actually to continue to put pressure on these countries, not to just say yes, 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 and then never do anything about it. Actually, we need action.
The most disappointing part in all of that was that a lot of this money was publicly raised. Everyone had donated because they wanted to see us do well and they had pride in our team. So to turn up and at times not have balls to train with, you know, no kit, it just wasn't good enough.
I think he ought to be taken to a mental confinement. He is utter stupid.
Tell me a bit more about your encounter with the Prime Minister, because early on in the documentary, of course, you show a clip of him from a number of years ago when you were involved in a player's dispute with as a Samoan international, and he basically called you stupid and said that you should just stay out of it. And yet here we are a few years later, and you're sitting face to face in his office, and his parting words to you were, anything you can do to help us. So has his attitude changed?
Yeah, I think it has, you know, as much as probably people would have wanted me to go in there and really give a piece of my mind. Actually, within the Samoan culture, we still have to do things with a lot of respect. And even, you know, there's a lot of water under the bridge. It still had to be done within that context for me to come out of the film with any credibility, but also with the Samoan people and the people that I work with.
The whole thing is unfair. We are helping to replenish the huge bank accounts of the big boys, Tier 1.
I guess, you know, we haven't always seen eye to eye on certain issues, but I appreciate you having me here.
Whatever you can do to help us.
It's around about 11 million tala to fulfil all our programs. 60% is locally funded, with a few here and there from a few overseas partners that we have at the moment. And then the other 30% is funded by World Rugby. But we're in a difficult situation for us because we can't get those sizable sponsors because we don't play that many games. Without government, there would be no rugby union in Samoa, and that's the honest truth.
The involvement of politics in the islands is actually intertwined based on the system and not the other way around. I was always, as a player, if we cleaned up our own politics, that would be the problem solved. But sort of a turning point in the film is that actually we can't move away from government funding until some of the bigger fixes of the game are there, and there's a better profit share model, a more fairer profit share model in place that would allow the politicians and the government to move away in terms of their funding, to allow the unions to be able to bring and top officials themselves to run our unions in the right ways.
You can't be in a development partner relationship with an organisation who's going to hang the carrot of we're going to pull our money on you, right? It's like being married to someone who threatens to divorce you every week. If you're a partner that doesn't make me feel that the balance of power has been equaled out, then that's not the reality of the relationship.
Rugby has never been the leading moral saviour of human rights. It's never protected human rights. Remember, rugby used to go to South Africa throughout apartheid. All blacks had to go, and if you took a brown guy, you had to be an honorary white. People are just ignorant to blaming it on the Samoa Rugby Union. There is a bigger enemy here. There is a bigger problem here, and that is World Rugby.
Eliota Fuimaonu Sapolu, he's a practising lawyer in Samoa. And it was really interesting. It was the first time I'd heard that myself. It's something that we'll delve into. We're well supported now through the legalities with Pacific Rugby Players Welfare. So it's, again, raises avenues for us to delve further into. We need to understand the bigger pictures here. And one of those is their borderline exploitation of Pacific players throughout professional rugby. It's going to require getting the right people around the table with the right ideas. But definitely everything that I think we addressed in the documentary and everything that was highlighted to us and through that 3-year period of sort of really investigating the issues is achievable, in my opinion. It may not happen overnight. It may not even happen in the next 5 years, but it could happen. We can't relinquish hope. Otherwise, you know, when it comes to Samoa and Tonga, we might as well stop playing rugby altogether.
We need to be receiving our fair share of money we are helping others to earn. Rugby's funding model has trapped the islands into a handout mentality, where a reliance on small donations has stolen our ability to earn greater income. We also need the eligibility rules to change so that we can access all of our players. Allowing a single change from a Tier 1 down to a Tier 2 nation of heritage would have an immediate effect on growing the global game. And best of all, it wouldn't cost a thing. Underpinning this all is the fact that it has to be changed to the way rugby is governed. We cannot continue to allow unelected, incompetent officials, government politicians, to use rugby for their own personal gain, while the Tier 1 nations continue to hoard the majority of profits and power to the detriment of our nations. If we can achieve these things, the future of Pacific rugby looks bright. And rest assured, I won't give up trying to improve the game we love.
That was former Manu Samoa international Dan Leo, and now CEO of Pacific Rugby Players Welfare, signing off his own documentary, Oceans Apart, which raises some critical issues for the future of the game in the Pacific. And the movie is available to watch online via either Amazon Prime or Vimeo. And the reporter was Richard Ewart, and the other voices you heard there were voices from the documentary.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
As the race to develop a COVID-19 vaccine continues, there is about to be a major push to eradicate another virus, and one which we already have a vaccine for. The World Health Organization has launched a plan to end cervical cancer, a cause championed by Australia, where significant progress towards that goal has already been made. Based at the University of Queensland, immunologist Professor Ian Fraser is the co-inventor of the cervical cancer vaccine and someone closely involved with the WHO campaign. Hamish McDonald has been speaking to Professor Fraser about the WHO's ambitious worldwide cancer elimination plan.
It will take a while because there are a whole generation of people who are already, if you like, incubating cervical cancer. So the aim is to get rid of it across the planet in the course of the century, but within Australia, within the next 10 years.
Were you surprised at the speed at which the WHO picked this project up?
Look, it's a clear winner from the point of view of public health because we have the means now to prevent a cancer, and this will be the first cancer that it's possible to eradicate through a combination of vaccination and screening.
How did it come about, though? I mean, did you go and present to the WHO? How do these things get decided?
Look, I think it was a joint decision amongst a number of people in Australia that we should talk with the WHO about the prospect of eradicating cervical cancer through vaccination and screening. And because Australia has been a leader in both screening and introducing the vaccine against HPV, it seemed logical that we should be the ones that went to WHO and said it's time to do this.
If this is going to be rolled out globally, how great is the risk of a sort of two-tier scenario where you get the developed world doing it pretty well and then poorer countries really, really struggling to do this?
Well, from a point of view of vaccination, we're fortunate that the companies that make vaccine have introduced a two-tier pricing system so that, if you like, the developed world has paid for the development of the vaccines and the developing world pays simply for the what's in the bottle, if you like, which is just the manufacturing and distribution costs. So that's enabled it as a possibility on a global basis at an affordable cost. The problem is actually with the screening side of things, because screening for cervical cancer requires trained individuals to use a laboratory test to look for evidence of either HPV or cervical cancer cells. And that is certainly more easily done in the developed world where there are good laboratory facilities. Developing these in the developing world is going to be more of a challenge.
Yeah, how do you do that? How do you solve that challenge?
Through education primarily, and also through making the test as simple as possible, so that now we can use a test where we can show that there is HPV there rather than looking for abnormal cancer cells. So we look for the virus rather than what the virus causes. And that test can be automated. It can be working off a battery-driven machine rather than one that requires mains electricity. And it just gives a readout positive negative. The art then is to test the right people and just make sure that we can catch the people who are at the age where persisting infection with papillomavirus gives a high chance of going on to cancer.
I know we're talking about different things here, but I suspect many Australians would be intrigued to hear your thoughts on the progress of the various COVID-19 vaccines. How encouraged are you?
Well, as Tony Fauci said the other day, the cavalry are coming. We've got now three vaccines where there is fairly clear evidence that they're able to protect against against the COVID-19 causing virus. And while they're not 100% effective and we don't yet know how long protection is going to last, this is much more encouraging than if we'd had three failed trials.
Multiple scenarios, though, presenting over 90% efficacy. Did that shock you?
No, I wasn't too surprised at that because we've known how to make vaccines for quite a while now. This was just another virus. I think the really interesting thing is that the new technologies, particularly the RNA-derived vaccines, have turned out to be as effective as the older technologies, protein-based. And that makes it much easier to make large amounts of vaccine quickly.
And have you been keeping an eye on what's going on with the University of Queensland trials? I mean, do you have much hope that we'll get an Australian vaccine?
I think we will have a protein-based vaccine from Australia, yes. The protein-based technology is, in the long run, probably more reliable. It's a better understood technology. And, of course, that's the one that the University of Queensland, amongst others, is using to develop a vaccine. It takes longer to get there because the process of making the vaccine takes a little longer. But protein-based vaccines do have the advantage that they're stable in the long term. So I'm kind of hoping that we'll end up with a mixture of the RNA vaccines right now to get protection on a global basis quickly, and then protein-based vaccines in the long term, because they'll be probably the ones that are easier to manufacture and distribute.
There does seem to be a bit of a perception that once the A vaccine or multiple vaccines are there and out in the market, this whole thing is over. It won't be quite like that. Can you, given your experience with rolling out the HPV vaccine, can you just help us understand what it might look like, what the timeline might be, how we as a country, as a planet, actually go about doing this?
Well, look, the first challenge, of course, is as yet, no vaccine has been shown 100% effective, and we don't know how long protection will last. So this would suggest that we're going to have people in the community who are still vulnerable to infection. And it also suggests that it's going to take quite a while to get everybody immunized across the planet. We haven't managed to achieve that for any other vaccine yet. So it's going to be quite a challenge to immunize the entire population of the planet. I suspect that we will be struggling to get a program in place that has produced complete protection across the planet within 5 years.
Professor Ian Fraser from the University of Queensland, and he was talking there to Hamish McDonald. That's the program. Just a reminder, Samoa has recorded its first case of COVID-19. Samoa's Prime Minister Tuilepa confirmed one patient arrived in a quarantine facility tested positive to the coronavirus. Don't forget that. Richard Ewart will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. And make sure you follow and like the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page so you can get the latest news and developments from around the region. I'm Marla Damati. Thank you for your company.